This Week in Retronauts.
Frog Blast Event Core!
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another Retronauts micro episode. Hopefully this one will be short and efficient. I make no promises because we are talking about a topic near and dear to my heart and that of one of our guests. With the third person here to be like, I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Hey, what are you guys doing? Why don't you lock me in this room, Jeremy?
And we are talking about Bungie's Marathon Trilogy. Or if we end up talking about the first game for a very long time, then we're going to talk about Marathon and get to the other parts of the trilogy sometime in the future.
Oh, we can probably talk about them all at
once.
The
micro thing is a ruse, I'm telling you right now.
If we're not through with the first Marathon by the time we hit the half hour market, then I'm gonna do an emergency bailout.
Okay. Yeah. That's not a lot. We'll see. Sequel,
so that's what that cord is on your seat.
Yep, it's actually an eject button. That's awesome. I send you first and
into the deadly towers.
That's right.
And then if I keep going on too long. All right.
So hi, I'm Jeremy Parrish, and with me here, you probably recognize the voices of
Ben Elgin.
That's right. I switched the direction this time.
You did.
Caught you off guard.
Benj Edwards.
And we're gonna talk about Marathon to the best of our abilities. So this is actually sort of a corollary episode to our Macintosh gaming focus, or our Apple gaming focused episodes, which we've had two now. And we will definitely touch on Marathon in the 90s Mac gaming episode that we'll eventually do. But I just love Marathon so much that I wanted to break it out into its own topic. And I know Ben is also a huge fan of the game and played it a lot back in the day, which is really when you needed to play the games. I admit it. They haven't aged that well, but they're really good. They were great for their time, and I have a lot to say about them, but I'll try not to be the only one talking for the next half hour. So anyway, Marathon. So Ben, what was your first experience with Marathon? Let's mix things up a little.
Oh, geez. I owned all of them. So the trilogy is, you have Marathon, and then Marathon 2, which was just kind of expanded on all the concepts, and then Marathon Infinity, which purportedly wrapped up the story in an incredibly complicated way, and also gave you the developer tools to make your own levels.
So you discover the game just by buying Marathon?
So I actually had Pathways into Darkness, which was Bungie's previous.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So
why don't you tell us about that one? Because that's one that I've always meant to play. I'm very aware and knowledgeable about it, but I've never played it.
So yeah, I did play it. I would not say I was super good at it. I'm not sure I actually legit managed to beat it. So Pathways was kind of a weird hybrid. So it had this first person interface, and you know, you could pick up guns and shoot monsters with them. So it had this first person shooter elements, but it was also very much an old style adventure game in that you were trying to piece together what you were doing. You could pick up various items and use them in various locations. One of the big features was actually like the ability to talk to corpses. So there's a crystal you pick up early on that'll let you stand over a corpse and have a conversation with it, so you can find out things about the plot and things about what other items do. Yeah. So like the overall thing is you're going down into this pyramid and like there's an ancient god sleeping at the bottom and you're trying to figure out how to hopefully.
Right. And the further down you get, like the more, like the closer you get to the ancient alien, it's basically Cthulhu.
Yeah. I was just about to say, is this an H.P. Lovecraft?
I mean, it's very much like Lovecraftian in that sense.
And the game sounds awesome.
Things get weird and like bizarre and surreal the further down you get. Oh, yeah. But sort of in the upper levels, you're mostly talking to the corpses of your fellow American soldiers.
Yeah, it starts out with a military aesthetic and just gets weirder from there.
But then as you go further in, you start finding the corpses of Nazis who went into the pyramid because of, you know, Hitler's obsession with the occult. Apparently he was trying to wake the sleeping god or whatever. So, yeah, it seems like a very interesting premise, and I think it was kind of betrayed by its technology. I've played a little bit of it.
Yeah.
I want to be it's, like... Okay, so I didn't play much of it, but I played a little of it, and it's very clunky as a shooter.
It's very clunky.
And the shooter kind of gets in the way of the adventure.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Because, the shooter was the part I was not very good at, which is why I would hit roadblocks when you know, monsters would just come up and kill you. And you're playing the first-person part of it in this very little window. It's pretty primitive. It's sort of along the lines of Wolfenstein.
What sort of machine would you play this on back in the day? What
60/20
color Mac,
60/20 or 60/30. Okay. So yeah, it would run on an LC.
Eventually, I had a Centris, but this may have
been
the
2SI kind of era, maybe, or 2C.
It might have been a little more demanding.
I've got the manual if you want to look and see what.
Of course, the 2CI costs like $10,000.
You want to see if it has cracks in there? There's the manual.
Okay, Pathways into Darkness. It also says Corpse Whisperer is the subtitle.
No.
Okay, I just made that up.
No. So it's a very primitive sort of first person thing. It's a little slow. It's a very tiny window. You have a pretty short draw distance. And it's very maze like, as in a lot of the old first person stuff would be. But when it tries to get action-y, it's pretty clunky.
Yeah. It feels very much like they played Ultima Underworld, which was what, 1991? Mm-hmm. And said,
no,
this is
too early. 93.
Oh, okay, so it was pretty contemporary.
It came around the time Wolfenstein 3D came out, and they're still bitter that they didn't
Ultima
get credit
Underworld
for
came
that.
A little before Wolfenstein.
It was essentially simultaneous, and maybe a couple months later.
Okay, so Pathways like into Darkness was also 93. So
yeah,
a lot of people kind of coming up with the same
Wolfenstein
ideas.
Wolfenstein 3D
at the same
was 92, right?
So okay. Yeah, I think it was already becoming clear that this sort of first-person 3D thing was where a lot of good stuff was going to go, and people were trying to make it work. And this was
okay. Here's the system requirements
system
for
requirements,
Pathways.
Okay,
if you want to know. Mac computer with a 68020 or better, system 6.05, hard disk 2 megabytes of free RAM.
So anything with a 68020
is what
RAM. Yeah.
So you had to pay a high Mac tax to be able to play this game.
There was no such thing as a small Mac tax back then.
They were expensive computers.
So we were just coming out of the era we were in our previous Mac episode. We were mostly talking about 2D games and just starting to get into cool color 2D games. And now suddenly we've got people coming along and trying to make 3D really work.
Right. And so, Bungie was definitely at the forefront of that for Macintosh. And they were an interesting studio because they were entirely Macintosh focused in the darkest age of the Macintosh. No one wanted to support the Mac in the 90s.
I mean,
it was a dying platform.
They were heroes.
This is why I was playing these games, because Bungie was there for
us,
man.
This is why I gave Destiny a chance, because I still feel a little bit of fondness for Bungie.
Yeah, everything else was going on over on PC, but Bungie was making things.
Although I think the only person from Bungie in the original era still there is Jason Jones, who runs the company, and apparently is like a ghost figure who shows up sometimes and then doesn't.
Yeah, I don't think any of the original people are still working on things there.
He does what he wants to do.
Marathon was definitely their next big thing.
And
I don't know if you've ever played any of the alpha versions of the game, or like their tech demos. There was I can't remember. I think it was a Mac Addict magazine, or maybe Mac World
may have had a demo. Yeah,
it was one of the two, but it was basically like
it has some Mac worlds.
And actually, maybe one of the Marathon discs, maybe one of the sequel discs, actually had the game.
Oh, they
versions
put it in, when
locked.
They put out when they put out the trilogy in a box set. They had a bunch of extras in it.
Okay,
so it may
have
come out in that.
Okay, so it was somewhere. I don't remember exactly where it was, but I do know that there were like old versions of the game and. Yeah. In the very beginning, it very much felt like the next Pathways into Darkness. It was very like orthogonal spaces and very slow paced and clumsy. and kind of ugly looking, but they kept iterating on the technology and eventually came up with a 3D engine that wouldn't run. I guess it would run full screen if you wanted, but it was a bad idea because you lost the entire HUD, but otherwise it was kind of windowed. So it was like three quarters of the screen.
You hit F1, don't you?
I don't know.
Full screen.
I don't know.
You're talking about Marathon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just played it this morning. It was so demanding. The cool thing is it has all these incremental. If you push F1 to like F9 or something, it just gets worse and worse and worse. Like it gets interlaced and it gets low resolution and stuff. So you could play it on a pretty, you know, less demanding machine.
I'm not sure if that was even in the original build. The shortcuts may have been added later. But
I played the original.
You could play.
There were shortcuts to the.
You just never touched.
Because you could also. set all these things in a setup screen, depending on what hardware you had.
Yeah. So anyway, they kept refining the technology and eventually came up with a pretty cool first person shooter.
Weren't there no function keys on most Mac keyboards? That was only the extended.
You may have had to do like.
So that's why you probably never hit those. Yeah. Because on most Mac keyboards that were shipped with the machine, they didn't have function keys.
Yeah, they didn't back then.
Just that extended thing. Anyway.
But yeah, so the engine they ended up with was really cool because it kind of leapfrogged from this very primitive one they had in Pathways to something that was in a lot of ways more fully featured than, say, the original Doom engine and Wolfenstein ones.
Yeah, Marathon came out pretty much at the same time as System Shock on PCs. And they both did a lot of things that the other tried to do. System Shock had more of like a full inventory system and was more of a proper RPG. And I think Marathon was a little more technically sophisticated. Like it had, you know, vertical aiming.
It had real verticality.
There was this really weird element to the game engine. You know, it was the 2.5D design that you saw in, you know, stuff like the Doom engine, the Build engine and so forth. But the way they built the engine, it's hard to explain, but basically you could have spaces that overlapped with each other.
Yeah.
As long as the vertices of their defining boundaries, their defining polygons didn't overlap, didn't touch, then you could have spaces that existed within the same space, which doesn't make any sense.
You could go
into one room and then kind of like follow a hallway around and go back into that same space and it would be a different room.
So the reason this happened was because this was part of the tricks they did to make something 3D before things were really fully 3D. So none of these games like Doom and
there's no
Marathon.
Real like levels are basically defined by not, you know, like height.
They're
or
height
like
maps.
That.
Yeah. 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 So you don't have real full 3D models of these levels. They're all defined in 2D layouts, but then given heights. And so it's designed so you can do things like, you know, go down a set of curved stairs and come out in a basement that's defined to be a different height.
Basically, yeah. So let me interject. Like each portion of the screen each portion is defined by small polygons,
right.
And each polygon is given its own properties, its own height. It's like this is a lava tile or whatever.
And because we don't have a real full 3D environment. The system is, and when it finds out like where you can go and what you can see, it's not really just, you know, casting rays into a 3D environment. It's just going from one polygon to the next connected polygon is the way it's programmed internally. So if you have polygons that aren't connected, even if they're technically in the same space, you can't go between them. You can't shoot between them. You can't even see between them. But you can do, you can do weird, like four-dimensional stuff. You can have TARDISes, basically. You can have something that looks a little from the outside and then you go through it and it's actually fills up the whole space.
I was just going to say, like, I designed a house once and had the same problem. Vertices everywhere.
Okay.
You can go within other rooms.
And this all didn't really become apparent until Marathon Infinity when you can make your own and like all the underlying tech sort of was suddenly visible.
But it did allow them to do some kind of weird and interesting things. And you had these very elaborate maps that, you know, compared to like Doom were just extraordinary. You know, most shooters at that point were still using orthogonal space where it was like you could look in eight directions polygons could exist, shapes could exist in one of eight directions, cardinal directions and the corners. But here it was just like whatever.
Like Doom had a height map, but it was a single height map. and all it affected was the visuals.
Right.
So like you didn't aim up and down. If there was a demon
on a ledge,
everything
you would aim in that direction and shoot.
Yeah,
and
everything snapped to whatever the height map said was the height for
I
that
think
thing.
In Doom you couldn't have rooms on top of each other. Right,
you could not.
But could you do that in Marathon?
You could do that in Marathon.
Okay, well that's an interesting
you could do all kinds of weird things and it became very like it allowed them to do some pretty complex level layouts.
Yeah, because of these the restrictions of having to connect one polygon to another, like there were restrictions, like you couldn't have two doors directly above one another. You could only have a door there, but then you could have a door offset and up higher, and then the rooms behind them could be over one another.
Yeah.
It was sort of this weird in between tech that had some weird restrictions, but you could do a lot with the way they set it up in Marathon, and you did have real Z aiming.
It goes to show how much we take modern 3D engines for granted.
Right. Yeah.
Now level design and stuff where you can just do whatever you want and all those problems have been solved.
Right.
But these people, the developers were solving these problems, you know, at this time, the John Carmacks and the Jason Joneses. They were doing these things.
Yeah. There was no 3D engine. You couldn't just build something and say, have it, you know, do what it's supposed to do. You had to, there were these low level tricks that it was using to make things that looked like an enormous 3D space when really that's not how it was stored.
Yeah, the first 3D polygonal FPS engine was Quake, right? That was 96?
I think
that
so.
That was actually,
at least the mainstream, first mainstream.
Right. So this predates that by a year, year and a half.
Yeah.
So obviously they didn't have all those tools available to them. But, you know, they took what they had available and they kind of gimmicked it as much as they could and came up with a really fast-paced first-person shooter that also had a really strong narrative and exploratory element to it. I mean, even though you move from stage to stage, it's not like this massive interconnected space. Within each stage, there was a lot of kind of moving back and forth and solving puzzles and opening doors and throwing switches and so forth. And some of the levels were very intricate.
Yeah.
Like the engine also allowed you to do kind of interesting things like have levels that were based in vacuum. You had a health meter, a shield meter, and then you had an oxygen meter. That didn't come into play that often. Like you could go underwater and your oxygen would deplete, but then there were like two stages in Marathon that were in vacuum.
Right.
And all of a sudden that became an issue because
suddenly there's a time limit. Yeah.
Not only did you need to know where the shield charger was, you needed to know where the air charger was. And they kind of maxed that out in Marathon Infinity with a stage that you have to complete with no air chargers. There's just like a few oxygen bottle pickups that'll partially restore you. So it's like a hard time limit for this really complicated level. So there's some really kind of ambitious hardcore design going on in the Marathon games.
I'd like to interject just for a second that it occurs to me, I was a PC guy in the 90s and you guys were both Mac users. So Marathon meant so much more to you. We touched on this a little bit where that they were supporting the platform when other people weren't. And I was just wondering, what did you think of Doom when it came out? Were you jealous, you know, when you couldn't run it on your Mac? And was Marathon the answer to that? You know?
Yeah, very much.
I don't know. I don't know that I was jealous of Doom. I saw it and thought, that seems interesting, but I'm not really sure about the heavy metal cover vibe to it.
Hmm.
And at first, I was actually really dismissive of Marathon because I thought, oh, it's just more of the same, and I don't really think Doom is like my jam. But then I actually watched someone playing it a bit, and he was solving puzzles, and like he started reading all this narrative text in a computer terminal. I was like, well, this is really not what I expected. This is interesting. So I tried it out and really got into it. So I actually think Marathon was a game suited to my temperament, whereas Doom I've learned to appreciate, but it's not a game that I would just automatically was like, yeah, I just want to go kill stuff really fast.
Yeah, I mean, somewhat similar to that for me, although, you know, I got right into Marathon from Pathways, so I actually am not sure I played Doom at all until after I'd first seen that, had some time with the first Marathon. So for me it was like, yeah, this is all right, but it's like it can't do quite as much with the physics as Marathon can, and it's got no story.
I didn't even care about the first person shooter at all until I played Dark Forces. And then I was like, oh my God, it's Star Wars and an FPS or a Doom clone. this is amazing. And that came out on Mac and PC at the same time. So there wasn't really a sense of like, oh, I'm missing out.
Because I see you guys, your eyes are lighting up like crazy when you talk about this. It's a profound cultural experience, this marathon.
Yeah, I don't think it's just like, they're the only ones who love the Mac, so therefore I love this game. There were lots of Mac games I played back then that I was like, this is crap. Yeah. And there were lots of ports of games, you know, simultaneous ports, simultaneous releases from other publishers where games were like, eh. But Marathon did have this very unique combination of like Twitch action and very thoughtful, kind of elaborate, labyrinthian narrative that was very intriguing. And it's one of the few games I've played, especially the third one, where you really have to sit down and like puzzle things out. You have to pay attention. You have to put things together. And it doesn't feel like it's pushing too hard to be like, aren't we mysterious? Ooh, it's like an ARG. Like there are games now that I think do that naturally and intuitively, but there are a lot of games that are like, oh, this game is so deep and so mysterious.
It didn't get in your way. Like it was like, mostly it was optional. Like you needed to interact with the terminal some to figure out what you were doing and where you were supposed to go. But like the deeper story stuff, it was in there, but you didn't have to spend time with it if you just wanted to run around shooting stuff. That was fine.
You have to talk to computer terminals to advance the story and to activate certain switches and stuff, but you can literally just tab through and not pay attention to a single word that shows up and figure out what you need to do by just killing everything and finding your way to
do it. Yeah, it occurs to me that this is like, this Doom versus Marathon is sort of like Mac versus PC, where PC was quick and dirty and stuff. Marathon's a thinking man's game with aesthetic
PC had
qualities.
System Shock, which was very much along the lines of Marathon.
Well, so, I'm trying to simplify this to black and white.
I don't think that works, though. Sorry.
But yeah.
Saying there's value. There's something about the design of Marathon that's reflective of the Macintosh mindset culturally of users of the Macintosh at the time. It feels like a Mac game, not like a game that would be on the PC. There's something intricate and aesthetic about it.
Marathon 2 was on PC.
Yeah, no, I mean, there were certainly...
I'm talking about the first Marathon.
there were games on PC like that.
Nobody played Marathon 2 on PC. I never heard of it till later.
Came after Quake, for PC, so why would you want to play it?
Yeah, and they were coming off Pathways, which was this whole like adventure game paradigm. So there's still all this story stuff in there that you can dig into if you want to. And man, there was a lot of it. Like, so there's this website that was since Marathon started, called the Marathon Story Pages. And there are thousands and thousands of pages of like digging and analysis in there, in that website. And it was a whole community. Like Jeremy's in there somewhere, I'm in there somewhere. We all sent in stuff. They would do contests about, you know, obscure trivia and have people send in like new things they'd found about, because there was just all over, and you know, some out of the way terminal, there'd be something, or there'd be some bit of environmental storytelling. Or
especially in the third game, there's so much that's hidden out of the way, and you really have to like, it's really explore the stages to find these interesting clues to what the story is actually about. Yeah.
And there was stuff like, and the third game of course had level editors, right? And there was stuff written in the maps of the levels that you would find if you went in and looked at them with the level editors.
Yeah, like, one of them says like Bob's late for his big date.
But then also like Jaro were at Tau Ceti, which is like, you know, the big mysterious precursors of the game were at the planet where you started the first game at, which
the Jaro were the race that in Pathways into Darkness told you like, hey, there's this thing about to wake up under a pyramid.
Yeah, well, and
they're
also
like the alien emissaries.
And they were also the things that had trapped so this comes back in Marathon Infinity. The plot is, because you won in Marathon 2, before this slaver race that you've been fighting basically had a hissy fit and caused the son of a local system to go Nova, and oops, there's a Cthulhu monster inside, turns out. So then we got to do something about that in Marathon Infinity. And the Yara were also the ones who had imprisoned it.
This is a cultural phenomenon, the likes of which most PC users have no idea.
PC gamers have all kinds of stuff like that.
I just don't know. I don't see it.
There's
nobody's writing this stuff about Doom or Quake or whatever.
Well, those games weren't focused around the narrative, like System Shock. You had you have Elder Scrolls games. My God, there's tons of stuff like that on PC. I think Marathon stands out for Mac users just because it was one of the few instances of a game like that making it to the platform. System Shock did eventually make it to Mac, but it
attracted a big community because it was like a religious
experience or something.
No,
it's thousands of pages written about it, interpreting the story, and you know,
Yeah, and there are games like that on PC too.
No, I've never heard the like of that anywhere.
You need to pay more attention. Elder Scrolls for one.
Okay, well, that wasn't a first-person shooter, was it?
No, it was a first-person RPG.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think Terry's right that things like this existed elsewhere, but there was a sort of a unique community for this because it was the big action and story thing that was unique to Mac at the time, and so it attracted a lot of people from... That, you know, attracted people who liked action games and people who liked deep story and so on, who all happened to own Macintoshes, all kind of came together for this moment. So
really cool.
I mean, any game with, I think, a pretty well-developed world and a pretty elaborate narrative will eventually get its own fan base that dissects everything. I mean, look at, you know, Zelda timeline theories.
Sure.
This is just like the Mac didn't have a lot of those games unique to it, and Marathon didn't have any traction on other systems. So it's, you know, kind of a symbiosis in that sense. It is the symbiosis that exists on Mac, but there's plenty of those on consoles, on PC. This is just the experience that we had because we happened to own Macs. Yeah. And I owned a Mac because I wanted to be a graphic designer. And in the 90s, if you wanted to do art and graphics and desktop publishing, you owned a Mac. So
yep,
that
yep.
was the place. That was how I came across. Yeah. So Bungie, you know, they supported the Mac and were pretty unique in that respect. There were a few other companies that did. You had Spiderweb Software kind of pop up around the same time, and they've never found the same traction. I guess because it's Exile. One guy. Yeah, Exile.
Yeah, okay.
It's basically one guy, and he makes RPGs that are like visually about 15 to 20 years out of date.
Yeah, it's a little more niche.
They're good. They're really good, and they have even more narrative and much more elaborate world building, but. It is definitely like if you are into the CRPG style of the early 90s, then you will love Spiderweb's games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whereas this
kind
was
Ultima-like.
Very Ultima-like. Mm-hmm. Whereas Marathon was very much, you know, kind of the times. Like it was a cutting edge first person shooter that had some technical advantages and design advantages over what was popular on PC and in some ways wasn't quite as good. So, you know, it was the kind of thing that just builds, you know, Star Wars versus Star Trek rivalries. Yeah. It's like, you know,
it was actually competitive with PC offerings.
Yes. Yeah. And that was uncommon in Macintosh day, mm-hmm. Macintosh gaming.
And it became, as it went on, the first mod community on Macintosh. Like you had those communities spring up around Doom and things mm-hmm. too. And
Dark Forces also had a mod
Dark Forces,
community.
Yeah.
I think Dark Forces showed up like a year later. Maybe not even that long.
Wasn't it 96?
No, it was 95.
Too late, yeah.
Was it 95?
Okay. I think it was like mid-95, actually. So it was like 6 months after Mac, or after Marathon.
But yeah, and then I think Bungie was one of the early companies to really embrace their mod community to the point where they started hiring people out of it. So you had people doing art and level design for the later Marathons that were people who had hacked mods for the early ones, mm-hmm. and people who were big in the fan communities. You know, they hired artists who were off out of the like story pages and so on. And then of course with the last release, as we mentioned, they went and just straight up released their own dev tools for it. So Marathon Infinity came with Forge and Anvil, which was the level editor and the art, music, and physics editor.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about Marathon is that so much of its DNA still exists in the things Bungie is creating. Like, Halo is very much like, what if we made Marathon a console game? I mean, you've got so many of the same concepts, like the bizarre thing that is a threat to all life that they've discovered, and artificial intelligences that go rampant and take on a life of their own and become a huge threat if you're not careful, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, very much carries on their themes.
I mean, the Covenant is basically the Four, where you've got like a master race. No, that sounds bad.
Hierarchical slavers.
Basically, they are a slaver race led by kind of like a high-end non-combatant race that then have all these client races who are very analogous to the races
in Marathon. Specialized into various uses, yeah.
Like hunters or taken
straight
from.
Sounds like a racing game.
Afraid not. It's a racist game.
But
and then, you know, in Destiny, you still see things like the rampant AIs and unknowable threats from outer space and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So,
and that's,
yeah,
and
like
that's
this
why,
DNA, it's just part of Bungie. It's who they are.
Yeah, and that's why the hookup. I mean, I remember at the time, Microsoft buying Bungie, everyone was like, what? Yeah. What the heck is going on?
Traitors.
Like, it was a betrayal. Traitors.
But I mean, from Bungie's perspective, I mean, Bungie pretty much said as much, like Microsoft was giving them whatever they wanted to make their vision into cutting edge console games. I mean, they had input onto, they said they essentially had input into the hardware specs on Xbox. So it's sort of, I mean, you can definitely see why from a developer standpoint, this was, you know, a ridiculous opportunity for them.
They were clearly very, very talented and they needed to be enabled by a budget to do amazing things.
Yeah, they were a dinky little independent company that, you know, when they started talking about Halo, that was originally going to be a Mac game.
Yeah, I remember
and Steve
that.
Jobs brought them out at Macworld.
Yeah.
But that was basically the point at which go to Waypoint and read their history of Halo. It kind of gets into what happened with Bungie around that time. And it has nothing to do with Marathon, but it kind of shows the direction the company went. But basically, it was a small publisher or small developer that wanted to go bigger. And had a lot of ambitions. You know, they produced Myth, which was the first fully 3D real-time strategy game.
I could go on and on about Myth, too.
Everyone was able to get into that one. And they tried some really brave things that didn't work out, like Oni.
Yeah.
Which was the game where everyone realized, if you model 3D spaces after real-world architecture, they're not very interesting for a video game. But it was a good try. They tried. Came before all of that, and it really kind of was the launching point for Bungie, like the sort of cult that they built up around this game. I don't think they became rich off of Marathon, but it established their reputation.
I mean, for something that was primarily available on Mac, I think it did quite well for
them. Well, you know, Marathon 2
did make it
to PC, and then I think the original Marathon combined with Marathon 2 came to Pippin as Super Marathon.
Super Marathon.
Yeah.
But apparently that never actually made it to retail because a boxed copy of Super Marathon is
worth $1,000.
It's extraordinarily rare. One of the guys who ported Marathon 2 to Xbox 360, like that's his holy grail. He wanted to find a copy of that game, but was not able to.
Well, and then eventually they open sourced the whole trilogy. So, so now it's out as, what's it called?
M1A1?
Aleph 1,
that's right.
Aleph 1.
Yeah.
And so there's a site out there where you can just get all of them.
M1A1 is a special version for the first game, Marathon 1 for Aleph 1.
Okay, Marathon. Yeah. So it's the rebuild of Marathon 1 in the new engine.
Right.
So Bungie eventually open sourced the whole thing, and then people have since basically rebuilt it from the ground up to run on modern systems.
And after the developer tools Forge and Anvil came out, the games took on a life of their own and got these like total conversions.
Yeah.
I never really played any of them just because I never really had time, but they seemed really interesting. Like they were very ambitious.
Yeah, people built entire other games in like different
settings. A lot of them were just like, hey, this is basically Marathon 4. Let's just continue with the same themes as the first game, which that's not interesting. Do something new. No offense to everyone. I get it. Like, I understand the desire to do that, to like build on what's come before, but I kind of feel like Marathon was a complete story. It had a beginning and an end.
Yeah.
And like, I don't want to know about the further adventures of Leela the AI. It's okay. Like, she was kind of given a footnote and that was fine.
You're a Marathon purist.
I am. Keep it to canon.
Now, there's an element of marathon that was important. Sorry to interrupt you, but you can touch on this after you talk, Ben, which is that the networking thing. Did you guys ever play it on the network?
Yeah. Not the first one, but I did play the sequels.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, so we did LAN parties in college. After Marathon 2 and Marathon Infinity came out, I started building network game levels of my own for us to play. I actually basically built our dorms in some of the academic buildings in Marathon. only because you could do crazy things, as we were talking about at the beginning with the engine. I did things like, okay, this is my dorm, only if you go into my dorm room into the closet, then there's like an elevator to a portal to like an underground tunnel that goes to the other buildings, and then there's a TARDIS in this other closet that's an entire arena, and so yeah, we had good times with that.
I thought about doing that with my school campus, like, oh, it'd be cool to turn these spaces into like a virtual space.
But in hindsight
it's probably good that I didn't do that, because apparently that's like there's been some bad stuff that's happened with people who did that.
I mean, Marathon is at least enough of a fantasy setting that I think you can kind of divorce it from the issue of actual guns
space
on campus.
But I actually
took polls around my dorm, like, what do you want in my in your room? So like one person's room was underwater, and like at that point the realism is kind of out the window. So
yeah, that's true. I didn't really like. This is the game where I discovered, oh, I don't really like playing competitive gaming that much. Like, I played some death matches.
Yeah, we didn't take it too seriously.
For months at a time, I would play, and I was always like, oh, you know, I can hold my own pretty well. But I just, it's not really doing much for me. But then Marathon Infinity came out with co-op in the campaign mode.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really that well designed. It wasn't really made for it. There were like one or two places where you could only do stuff by teaming up with someone else. Uh-huh. And it was totally optional. But the idea of being able to play with another person in, you know, the campaign mode, that was really fun. I was never able to talk anyone into playing the whole Marathon Infinity campaign with me all the way through. But what little I did of it was really cool. And when they finally added that to Halo with ODST, like, I was all over that. It was really great. So that's what I'm into.
Co-op. Yeah, I never did a lot with the co-op, just because you said it wasn't really built with it for a whole lot. Our scene was just more the pickup and land play. Unfortunately, no one in our group was like ultra competitive, so it was really just kind of casual, blow each other up for an evening and have fun.
Are there enough people with mechs at your school to play this together?
So I'm thinking about it now. I remember we played it down in a computer lab. So I think I must have taken, like, I know I built my levels on my Mac, but I must have just taken them over to like a Windows version of Infinity or two and played them on that.
I worked on the student newspaper, and everything was Macintoshes in the student lab.
Oh, well, yeah, so that'll work.
So not only that, but we had Power Macs. So
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, I had a Power Mac that I bought to do independent study stuff at college. So that was really useful.
Yeah. So there were like six stations right there. An embarrassment of riches.
Yeah, but Marathon was on the forefront of the whole network play thing, because even Marathon 1 back in 94 had like network play with microphones and stuff, which was not a thing that happened a lot back then.
So, yep. I agree.
Yeah.
Well, we're half an hour into this episode, and we're not all even right to Marathon 1.
Well, we've been talking about all of it.
Yeah. So. But that's fine. It's kind of an all-inclusive thing. So Why don't we just kind of touch on the things that actually were sort of memorable and interesting about Marathon? To me, it's very much, it's a combination of narrative and atmosphere and level design. Like, to me, those three elements really clicked, and that's what makes Marathon so interesting. You know, there's a lot of variety in sort of the level settings and concepts. Even in the first game, when you're just in the colony ship, you know, you play most of it. You're in a colony ship that's been carved out of the moon, the Martian moon Deimos.
Deimos, yeah.
And then it's like self-propelled and flying off to colonize another planet. So it's very kind of claustrophobic and kind of dark. And then sort of midway through the game, there's this rogue computer that kidnaps you and is like, so I'm going to use you for all, like, to find out all the things I'm interested in. So why don't you go over to the alien ship? I'm going to beam you over there. Mm-hmm. Why don't you take notes and tell me what you find? So against your will, you get beamed over into an alien ship, and all of a sudden you're in like this pulsing organic neon space full of like weird purple liquids and monsters you've never seen before, who have like weird fire guns. And you're just like, what the hell is going on?
And you're like, your like interface starts getting corrupted by like having problems with the alien tech. Like you, so you can pick up this, normally you pick up a weapon and like all the stats of it show up on your little interface. And then you pick up this alien weapon and you get
like static
garbage and static and weird things happen. Wow. Yeah. But, yeah. So even the first game has that variety, and then you get to Marathon 2, and it, you're right. We could go through and do more podcasts on individual ones, but
that's okay.
But it opens up even more because then you get outdoor environments.
Yeah, and you
get
start going down to the planet a lot,
and you get real liquids that you can move through.
Real liquids?
Well,
dynamic
liquids that you can actually go into, as opposed to just purely aesthetic backdrops.
Wow.
Which was a new feature at that time, at that point. And you have like ambient sound. Yeah, just the design of everything was amazing. I still remember like the loon sounds on the planet.
The second game is probably my favorite, just because it did represent a huge leap forward in the technology, and it didn't feel so cramped and crowded anymore. Yeah. And there's like the settings really reflect the narrative and the kind of the flow of the story. Like you go down and you're sort of exploring a planet for a while, and then the AI that's controlling you goes under attack by the aliens who want revenge on him, against him. So then you're summoned back to his ship, and there's some really great, just like super intense action only stages where it's basically like a one man holding effort against an army of aliens that are trying to get to the robots or the AI's core. And like, I feel like that level, I can't remember what the name of it was. It was something about a shotgun. I feel like that's what Bungie was trying to do in Halo with the library stage, but they just didn't pull it off. Whereas this is like, it feels like this desperate holding measure, and there are waves of enemies coming at you, and they just get bigger and more dangerous every time.
Yeah, it's like a one-man tower defense.
And then Durandal, like, all he can do to protect himself and to kind of arm you is to beam in weapons and ammo and stuff. So every once in a while, every few waves, you get more ammunition, and you get, like, a health refill, and then it's back into hell again.
Yeah, it was a great set piece, really.
And then that kind of turns into this sort of quiet stage where you're basically running through Durandal's core and destroying it, because he's like, I don't want to be taken captive by the enemies, just blow me up. And then that turns out to be a feint, and he's actually like stuck himself in a computer chip in your character's brain, because your character is a cyborg. And he's basically kind of like tilting the odds in his favor by making this ancient computer that's obsessed with balance think that you're like doomed, and the enemies have an upper hand. So when the ancient AI is like, oh, things are going out of balance, so then he like basically it's not very interesting to explain. It's very convoluted, but it's really fun to watch it unfold. And the way the game like shifts and evolves, like you get taken prisoner and all the cool stuff you have is taken away, and so you have to sort of fight back and rebuild your ammunition again.
I have a question. Metroid Prime. This reminds me, you know, you unveil a story as you scan things as you go along.
Yeah, I mean, Metroid Prime, I think, was very heavily influenced by Marathon. Also, System Shock. Like, both games have the same narrative approach, which is you get your story by accessing computer terminals. And that's one thing that I really like about the Marathon games, is that some of the computer terminals, the AIs are talking to you, whether it's one that likes you or one that hates you. But in a lot of cases, you find, like, backstory stuff. And the idea there, at least especially in the first game, is that the four slaver race has a client race called the Sfit that are basically computer hackers. And they are going up to terminals on the ship and trying to access all the data logs. So then you like will see one at a computer terminal and blow it up, and then go over to the terminal. And there's all this information that gives you backstory on the game and starts to give you clues about who you, the player character, are and so forth. Yeah. So it's kind of like there's a diegetic reason for these little breadcrumbs of narrative information to be doled out. So that's really clever.
And then of course they're still an enslaved race. So, you know, your AI people like Durandal are like, well, we can talk to them and let's work something out. And then, you know, so you have these shifting factions eventually, you know, things were, characters that were previously enemies start fighting alongside you. And
yeah, I mean, Doom had the element where you could like cause enemies to attack each other because there were different species. So character, you know, enemies of different species, if you could like kind of kite them around and get them to cause each other damage, you could make them fight. But Bungie actually turned that into a central element of Marathon, where basically the plot of the entire game, like the whole point that you're trying to accomplish for Durandal, is to liberate those computer hackers from the slaver race. And so there's one stage where you go and you like destroy the cyborg that is controlling the hacker race. And in subsequent levels, then the hackers are on your side. So it completely changes the power dynamic of the game. And then that's something that shifts back and forth, especially in the third game, where you're like traveling through time and trying to prevent the catastrophe from happening by like changing the timeline. And you end up serving like
third
different
faction with the ancient supercomputer.
Well, there's that. And then also like sometimes you are working for Durandal and sometimes you go back and you're working for the AI that hates him and wants to destroy him. So the human characters are trying to stop you in that case.
Yes. Yeah, now I can see why there's a 1,000-page story.
There you go.
There's a lot to this game. And, you know, even though the story plays out through the terminals, like if you're not paying attention to the terminals in the third game, you're like, why are the human bobs shooting at me all of a sudden? I don't understand. And even if you do pay attention to the terminals, it's still very confusing.
The third really ramps it up, but you know, you can still kind of blow through it. But.
Yeah, it has those electric sheep stages, which become progressively weirder and more complex. And which
turn out to be your own subconscious.
Yeah, it's like you're fighting through your subconscious mind, sort of liberating yourself from the shackles of the AI slavers.
That's crazy.
It's a really interesting game,
and it does a lot both in terms of the action and in terms of the story to do the most with what it has. So like the fact that the most interesting characters in this game are computer AIs is not a coincidence, because it means you can interact with them at a computer terminal rather than trying to have convincing real people. You know, there's people in the game, but the bobs, you know, there's these little pixelated blobs. You're not going to like form an emotional connection with them, really.
Well, except the ones that run at you and explode because they're actually the alien parasites. Ones, like, you learn to hate them. That's kind of an emotional bond.
But yeah, no, it's lack of a bond.
Like, this game kind of, it has that same problem that you saw in, like, BioShock 13 years later, where you have, you know, characters that they want to talk to you. The developers wanted to have talk to you, but you can't really interact with them. So you're just basically having one-way transmissions from people telling you what to do. You can't shoot them. They're telling you what to do on a computer terminal. Oh, yeah. So you're just like, there's the guy who's like, after Durandal gets blown up, he's one of the human resistance who's like starts giving you orders. Mm. And he's actually like a photograph of Jason Jones, who's been given like a fake cyborg augmentation. And you like just get orders from him. And then when Durandal wakes up, he mysteriously disappears. It's almost like Durandal wasn't dead at all.
Yeah.
So strange.
Mm-hmm. Durandal's a great character.
Happy.
And the Marathon story page was great because it noticed things like when the human resistance leader is talking to you, his, the IP from which he's communicating to you, it's like the server is called Piltdown, which is a reference to Piltdown Man, which was a famous hoax. So there's like all these little breadcrumbs that people kind of piece together and are like, so what's actually happening here? And that's what makes Marathon so interesting. They put a lot of thought into the story, and they did a really great job of building the story and the action into sort of a cohesive whole.
Yeah.
And who was the architect of that story? Was it Jason Jones or someone?
I think Jason Jones was a big part of it. Alex Seropian.
Seropian.
And then the third game was developed by an offshoot of Bungie called Double Ought. It was like some guys who worked with Bungie and then went off to do their own studio. They handled the campaign.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the names of the people who were involved, but
there's credits in one of these manuals. Okay. Well, product design, Jason Jones. Programming, Jason Jones.
Story
Ryan,
is
Martell.
Greg Kirkpatrick and Colin Brent.
Kirkpatrick.
Yeah, Greg Kirkpatrick was the one who kind of guided the story all the way through to the end.
Yeah. That sounds right.
Up to these days,
Colin and Greg. I don't know. I think he went to Double Ought and then left the games industry, if I'm not mistaken. Which is a shame because he came up with a really cool story. I mean, the final story ends with you, like the final game ends with you, like becoming the god of destiny.
Wow,
it's a little bit transcendent. It's kind of heavy.
Yeah,
heavy.
But the third game,
mind blown.
The third game, like I said, it has a really complicated story, but they match it with the just like the pinnacle of game design in this kind of 2.5D shooter space. There's a level called Acme Station because it's like the most you could possibly do with this engine, and it's a really difficult level because it's very intricate, very complicated. It's all based in vacuum.
That's the vacuum.
It has like all these narrow hallways and it's like crazy lines of sight, which shouldn't have been possible with the technology. And there's enemies like shooting at you and dropping explosives that track you down the halls. And you're trying to achieve objectives before running out of oxygen. And then you go to the next stage and it's still in vacuum. So you're like, oh my God, I have to find a station to save and to refresh my oxygen. It's great. Great games.
Yep.
I'm really sad that they never managed to put Marathon Infinity and Marathon 1 out on Xbox Live Arcade because the plan that they had, Freeverse Software, who did the development on Marathon Infinity, if the game was a success, if the game was enough of a success, they were going to put out Marathon 1 and Marathon Infinity as like DLC for that and just run them on the same engine so you could get the whole trilogy. But apparently, Durandal did not do well on Xbox Live Arcade, and people were complaining because they got sick because of the head bobbing, and so on and so forth.
Speaking of getting sick, there's something on this page that I print out in trivia of the Marathon Bungiepedia wiki. It says, during Marathon's development, Bungie adopted a testing policy of play till you puke in order to play test the game. There's a period there. In order to play test the game, each member of Bungie Studios had to play from start to finish twice. The term was coined due to the nausea associated with playing Marathon for too long, usually setting in during the second playthrough.
Yeah, I can see that.
That's a long time to be playing.
There was a kind of a really hardcore fanaticism around playing the game. The Vidmaster's Oath, was that what it was?
Yeah, Vidmaster Oath. That's like, in back one.
You never run by pressing caps lock.
Yeah, don't kill
every born on board colonist.
This sounds like you're making this stuff up.
Nope.
I swear. No.
Always grenade jump.
This is alien culture to me.
Wasn't grenade jumping in there too?
Oh.
So here from the end of the manual for one is lessons applicable to the game. Move fast, seize the initiative, wield superior firepower, dive into the melee, anticipate enemy movements, slaughter the defenseless, endure.
That's not quite the Vidmaster's Oath, but no, it's close.
That was the first game version.
Who's the Vidmaster?
That's if you are good at Marathon, you are the Vidmaster.
Basically, if you could beat it on the hardest difficulty level, which was ridiculous.
Well, vidding was a special technique that they came up with because... you know, this was before like dual stick shooters and it was before full mouse and keyboard control. So they had, you know, like the standard control buttons, move forward, backward, strafe, right, left. And then they had buttons that let you look 90 degrees left and 90 degrees right. So vidding was what they called it when you were moving in one direction and you would turn in another direction and take down enemies.
Yeah.
Wow.
So by mastering that ability, which is something I could never do, it opened up your tactics and your capabilities in multiplayer, especially.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what vidmasters were, people who mastered that technique, which was just beyond me. I was just happy to beat the games on something other than easy.
Yeah, so the control scheme I played this morning was the numeric pad. It was moving me up forward and back and maybe...
And W.
Strafing left and right?
You can
left side there was some strafing. There's some looking. There's up and down looking. And all
it has, even in the default configuration, has multiple options because you can do... strafing and looking with separate keys, but you can also do them as modifiers instead if you want. So you can hold down one of the like shift or control or command keys and turn your regular movement into strafing or looking even if you want. I don't think I usually played it that way. I think I usually played it with the two sets. And you can also do mouse if you want.
Yeah, and there was kind of a complicating element in that I think Apple desktop bus connections could only register like three key presses at a time. And if you tried to do more than that, it wouldn't register.
Yeah, so, you could definitely run into problems.
Yeah. So that was good times. But anyway.
So we should say again, even though it didn't make it on Xbox Arcade, that you can get all of these still off of, if you look up Aleph 1 Marathon, you can get all three games on a new engine that'll run on any modern system, Mac, PC,
that's
Linux.
A-L-E-P-H.
A-L-E-P-H 1 Marathon. Look for Marathon at that. And also the story pages we were talking about, if anyone wants to dive into that, are still up. They're actually hosted. They're hosted.
It's a hell of a rabbit hole. And Marathon story pages where the first hints of Halo happened.
Wow. Where the,
Bungie,
there was an arc.
Bungie sent emails to...
That was the I Love Bees thing, wasn't it?
No,
it was, no, that was like...
I Love Bees was Halo 2.
That was Halo 2.
This was back in the 90s. Just Bungie was like sending emails to the story page guy, like dropping hints about the story of their next game that they were building.
Yeah.
And writing as Cortana. Was
now part of Windows 10.
Was the sword of the same temper as Durandal and Joyeus. So Cortana's name like kind of comes from the same concept as Durandal. I think whatever they had in mind for Cortana eventually changed. Like she was supposed to go rampant in Halo.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen until Halo 5. So
So
a bit of a delayed gratification there.
Those pages are hosted on Bungie.org now, but they're pretty easy to find. If you just Google Marathon Story, they'll come up and there's a lot.
Yep. All right. Well, I know you guys need to get home, so I will stop talking, but I could keep going.
Yep.
I won't, though. We'll talk a little more, probably a little bit more about Marathon in the 90s episode of Mac Gaming, which will be in a couple of months. And until then, just everyone go play Marathon. It's so good. Even though it's dated, it's fine. It's good.
Yep.
All right.
It's tricky.
Guys, thanks for stopping in. Tell us where we can find you.
Benj Edwards at benjedwards.com, patreon.com/benjedwards, vintagecomputing.com, benjedwards.com, all kinds of stuff. I'm all over the place.
I'm everywhere.
Wait, we can't end this episode without saying Frog Blast the Vent Core. Okay. Got that out of the way. I'm Ben Elgin. I'm Kieran, K-I-R-I-N-N on Twitter. But also Kieran's Retro Closet.tumblr. Only one N in that, Kieran. And I will definitely snap some shots of the manuals and stuff for Marathon around the time this episode is going up. So you can find that there.
We forgot something very important. You didn't reference Heianchio Alien.
I haven't yet. Just you wait.
Find a way to work it in.
Well, I mean, you have to dig holes to stop the four. I don't know. Anyway, so as usual, I've been Jeremy Parrish for Retronauts. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find me writing at Retronauts.com. And of course, you can find the Retronauts podcast that you're listening to now at Retronauts.com, on iTunes, on Podcast One, and on the Podcast One app. We're supported through Patreon, patreon.com/Retronauts. It's how I eat my food. So... yes, if you like the show, please support us. If not, that's okay. We'll try harder next time. So this was supposed to be a micro episode, but then the conversation went on a long time and it turned into something more than a micro episode. So I'm expanding it into a full-time episode or a full episode full-time. And I thought this would be an opportune moment to bring in some of Retronaut's writing contributors or bloggers and news people. So I am on the line now with Kishi.
Hi, I'm Kishi from Retronauts.
That's a great intro, very upbeat. So Kishi, tell us a little bit about yourself, if there's anything to be told.
What's that line from Goodfellas?
I don't know, I haven't seen it.
For as long as I can remember, I always wanted to be a Retronaut.
Okay, well that's pretty much that's the qualification we need.
Now I'm living the dream.
That's right. So, yeah, to kind of make your podcast inaugural debut, I guess that's redundant, I thought it might be good to go over probably the biggest retro gaming news of the past couple of weeks. And it is a couple of weeks old now, but I feel like it's going to continue to be sort of a big topic that will sort of dominate conversations about old games for a few months to come.
Definitely.
And that is the Super NES Classic Edition. So what is your first impression of this thing?
My first impression, I got up Monday morning and my girlfriend, I was making some tea or something, and my girlfriend said, "Have you heard about the Super NES Classic Edition?" I said, "No." She's like, "Yeah, it's got Yoshi's Island and Star Fox 2." And I said, "What?" Because, I mean, we all knew this thing was going to happen in some
form.
Well,
we assumed, but as we learned with the Classic NES Edition mini console, you really can't assume anything about Nintendo's business decisions, because you think, oh, they're going to do the thing that's going to obviously make them a lot of money. And they say, no, actually, we're going to do something completely baffling. Thanks.
That's true. And you can't always trust the rumors, no matter how many insiders agree with it. I'm still waiting for Mother 3 in English.
Yeah. Well, this, I mean, for all we knew, Nintendo was going to release, like, they were going to follow up the NES Mini with a Sega Master System Classic Edition or something, just to throw us off the scent. But they actually did the expected thing and came out with the Super NES Mini, or announced it. It isn't out until the end of September.
Yes. I would say the only unexpected thing about it is just what a strong showing they're putting on here. I mean,
but
it only has
21 games versus 30. That's a ripoff, right?
That is true, and it costs more, but for the games you're getting, I mean, back in the day, one of these games would have cost $80.
Yes, this does not have Chrono Trigger on it, does it? No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. That's
because
a major
Chrono Trigger with tax cost me $90 back in the day, back with my fat Clinton-era American bucks.
Yeah, so we should appreciate the deal we're getting here.
I don't disagree.
But I wrote an article. I wrote an article for Retronauts back in May called "Don't Let Hype Happen to You," sort of looking back at the lives left in shambles by Nintendo's failing to supply good numbers for the NES Classic Edition, and ending with a warning for people not to fall for the same trick twice when Nintendo announces the next big thing. And when I heard about this announcement, I just imagined Nintendo looking at what I wrote and saying, "You know what? Challenge accepted." Like, here's a rock solid lineup of 20 of the greatest
21.
Games.
21. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
20 of the greatest games and also a 21st game. And it could be crap. We don't know, because no one's ever played it in its entirety.
But this, I mean, the NES Classic Edition had a few games you could call filler, like Ice Climber or Galaga, the NES port of Pac-Man.
Yeah, I mean, I get why those games were on there. Maybe not Ice Climber. I don't know about that one. But Pac-Man and Galaga, I mean, those are crowd pleasers. Like, if you want to sell one of these devices to, you know, the average person who doesn't follow video games closely, but, you know, they're 40 years old, they remember being in the arcades as a kid, and going to the roller skating rink and seeing Pac-Man or Galaga and being like, oh, and tossing a quarter into it. Those games were there to kind of stroke that little bit of nostalgia in their brain and make them say, oh yes, I need one of these. Which wasn't actually necessary, because Nintendo underproduced the NES Mini so severely that casual buyers never actually saw one in stores.
Yes, you're absolutely right, though. The games they selected totally made sense for their nostalgic marketing approach. But for the Super NES Classic Edition, the games they've chosen, even the hardest of the hardcore fans could agree these belong on there. There's very little you could call filler. I mean,
the weirdest thing on this system, I think, is that we're getting Street Fighter II Turbo Hyper Fighting, which was the second Super NES Street Fighter game. But in Japan, the Super Famicom Mini is getting Super Street Fighter II, which was the third iteration of Street Fighter II, and had four additional characters and, you know, more gameplay modes and everything like that. That's really weird to me, and I don't know why we're not getting the more advanced game. I realize some people think that, you know, Hyper Fighting is the best Street Fighter 2, but I'm not sure I agree. And it's really weird that there's this one kind of sizable disparity with what is technically the same game.
Yeah, I could see the argument for both, and I think it ties into that nostalgic appeal we were just talking about. I think Turbo came out at a time when people were still like as excited they were ever going to be about Street Fighter 2, and by the time Super came out, everyone was just kind of sick of shelling out for the iterations.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I only bought Street Fighter 2 once on Super NES, and that was the first, you know, version, because Hyper Fighting was like an incremental improvement. It didn't really add that much in terms of content volume. It was just like, here's some extra modes, and you don't have to use a secret code to play character versus character, you know, like the same character versus themselves. But Super Street Fighter 2, I was tempted because it did offer more characters and had, you know, a greater volume of graphical detail and everything like that. So to me, like, that would be the more appealing game. It also had the code where you could make characters, like the CPU fight CPU, and it had the tournament mode. I know I've talked about this before, the battle of the fight of the Feilongs that my friends and I put together, where we used a code to make 16 different versions of Feilong fight in the tournament bracket mode. And we never touched the computer, and we just wanted to see which Feilong would win. I don't remember which one it was, but it was definitely a Feilong. A Feilong won somehow. But, like, you know, the Super Street Fighter release for Super NES, I feel, was the most content-complete version of that game for the platform. So it feels a little weird that we're not getting that one. But aside from little nitpicks like that, and what they're not getting Dream Course over there, the Kirby's Dream Course. They're getting, I don't remember. They're getting Goemon, Mystical Ninja featuring Goemon instead of Castlevania 4. There's like three or four games that are different between regions. But
yeah,
otherwise, it's pretty similar. And everything we're getting here is like, oh, yes, I will play that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, F-Zero is a little perfunctory, but at least they didn't waste a slot on Pilot Wings again.
That's true. And, you know, F-Zero does have, at least beyond the perfunctory element of like, hey, this was the big tech demo game at the Super NES launch, it does have that sort of like, I don't know if it's ironic, but a little bit of cachet with Captain Falcon from Super Smash Brothers. Like, Captain Falcon is kind of a meme-ish character now, so I can see them including that for, you know, a couple of different reasons. It's not necessarily a game I'm super eager to play because it is a single player racing game.
Yeah.
But it was impressive at the time, and it does, you know, kind of have that legacy of a major character in Smash Brothers, which I know a lot of the Nintendo kids are really into.
Certainly. But yeah, when you go down the list, it's just classic game after classic game. Mega Man X, Super Ghouls and Ghosts, Contra 3, Kirby Superstar, on and on.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this, you know, the very limited lineup, it's only, again, 21 games versus 30 on the Super or the NES Classic. There are enough kind of seemingly huge gaps here that I could really see them justifying another one of these with another 20 games. Like, yeah, we've got Kirby Superstar and Kirby's Dream Course, but we don't have Kirby Star Stacker, or is that what it was called? Mean Bean Machine. Kirby
Avalanche.
Avalanche, that's it. God dang it, there's so many of those games.
There actually was a Super Famicom version of Star Stacker that only came out in Japan.
Oh, okay. Well, there's that. There's no Final Fantasy II. There's no Chrono Trigger. There's no Kirby 3, Kirby's Dream Land 3, which was kind of one of the technical high watermarks of the platform. Mega Man 7 is missing. Mega Man X 2 and 3. Like, there's a ton that is not on this system that you're like, oh yeah, if they put those on another one of these console iterations, I'd get that for sure.
Certainly. One of the most glaring omissions for me is Donkey Kong Country 2. And I understand why they'd want to put the first one on there, just for marquee value, and why they wouldn't want to put two of them on there. But for me, 2 just supersedes the first game in every respect.
Yeah, and you can't really say, oh, well, we only wanted to put the first game of a series on here because we've got Final Fantasy 3, but not 2. So that kind of, yeah, it's a little like, I'm sure they had to make difficult trade-offs, and I probably would have made some different ones. But I guess that's part of the fun of these is like, you know, complaining about the games that you really wanted to see and second-guessing the executives and whoever put this together.
Absolutely. On the whole, though, it's just so solid as a lineup.
So what do you think about the increased price? The NES Mini was $60. This is $80, and it only has two-thirds as many games. So where the Super or the NES Mini was basically like $2 per game, this works out to be about $4 per game.
Well, practically speaking, I think a lot of people aren't expecting to pay MSRP anyway.
Okay, so it's like $20 per game.
Yeah, due to how difficult it was to track down an NES Classic Edition, I think people are already steeling themselves to pay some kind of markup just to get their hands on one. Since then, people have sort of been feeling burned by the whole experience, which is good in a way. I'm seeing a healthy amount of cynicism from people just to protect themselves from the possible disappointment of not being able to find a Super NES Classic Edition. But I think part of that is people not expecting to find one for the $80 tag price, maybe expecting to pay some kind of markup.
I feel like Nintendo, I mean, I've seen where Nintendo has said that they're going to be, you know, producing this in greater numbers and making it more available. We'll see what that actually means. Sometimes they say one thing and they have some weird idea of what words actually mean.
Yes.
But maybe for once they're speaking the same language as us.
Yes, but just looking at the MSRP, I think the $80 price is fair, even for fewer games, because more of these games are deeper experiences than a lot of the NES games you'd see. As the 16-bit generation went on, games became deeper, more intricate, more of a time value. I mean, a lot of these games, they're not ephemeral experiences like an Ice Climber or a Balloon Fight. They're 20, 40, 50-hour RPGs like Link to the Past, Final Fantasy III. Even Kirby Superstar, which is a platformer, is a very long and intricate experience. So I think the price is fair.
Yeah, I think also people kind of need to understand the angle Nintendo's coming from. I'm not necessarily saying it's the right angle, but Nintendo, more than any other company in video games, is really determined to sort of preserve the perception of value for its games. I mean, we've seen that with like their mobile attempts and, you know, charging $10 for Super Mario Run, which kind of blew up in their face. But it was an attempt by them to say, like, our work has value, our products have value. And if you look at the way the pricing on this kind of breaks down versus on the NES Mini, it kind of parallels the pricing structure they've used on Virtual Console, where NES games are worth kind of a, you know, the least amount of money. And Super NES games are priced higher, and then you have like N64 games and kind of exotic imports that are priced with an even greater premium. And these prices, you know, these come to like, if this is $4 per game, slightly less, then that's half of what you would pay for each of these games on Virtual Console individually. So, you know, compared to sort of the pricing structure they've used in the past, it keeps the parallel, but sort of ratchets the price down to be a better value, assuming you can actually find an $80 Super NES Mini.
Certainly. And I'm definitely in favor of fighting the devaluation of classic games. You know, I'm not a very rich person. I don't think I'm speaking from a position of too much privilege here, but I'm willing to pay a fair price for even for a game that's been out 20 or 30 years, because I think those games still have value.
And I appreciate the fact that some publishers do still put effort into providing an experience that makes these games feel like they are worth something, as opposed to just shoveling a bunch onto a crappy emulator shell disc and saying, here you go, 60 games for $10. They're all crappy, but they're all good games preserved crappily. That doesn't do anyone any good. Like, if you just want a lot of games for very little money, just go emulate them. Just go steal the ROMs. I mean, this is a meant to be a better experience. It's meant to be a standalone plug-and-play system. This time they're putting two controllers in the box. Hopefully they'll have cables long enough that they'll actually be usable in an American living room. But this is meant to be, you know, a more premium experience. You don't have to fuss with things. You don't have to get your Raspberry Pi working. You don't have to worry about, you know, emulator GUI front ends. You don't have to worry about deleting your ROMs after 24 hours, et cetera, et cetera. Just get these 21 games, plug them into the TV, and go for it.
Another part of the value proposition, and really a huge part of the appeal of the Super NES Classic Edition that I've kind of been beating around the bush about, is they're finally giving us Super FX games, including Star Fox and the good version of Yoshi's Island.
Yeah, we've had Yoshi's Island available on for 3DS ambassadors, people who bought 3DS at the original full price and got 10 free GBA games, and also on Wii U Virtual Console. But both of those have been the 3DS or the Game Boy Advance iteration of Yoshi's Island, which was Super Mario Advance 3.
Yes.
And was a very good port for a system that was, in a lot of respects, less powerful than the Super NES and had no bonus chips to enhance its its capabilities, but it's not the same.
Yeah, it was fine on the GBA. They even added some extra levels, but it's just not the real thing. And this is the real thing, and it's never been offered by Nintendo since 1995 when it was on a cartridge. And even a lot of emulators don't run these Super FX games the way they should. So this is sort of adding a lot to the appeal of getting a Super NES Classic Edition and not just settling for an emulator.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a big part of the appeal. And, you know, the corollary to that is the fact that Star Fox 2 has never been released.
Oh, period. My goodness.
That game was canceled. And even the creators of the game at, you know, Dylan Cuthbert at Q Games now, he had no idea. This blindsided him. It came out of nowhere. And he was like, I met Dylan a couple of months ago when I was at Bit Summit in Kyoto, and I've been in contact with Q Games social media manager, and so I kind of was chatting with him about this whole thing, and he was like, yeah, Dylan he had no idea this was coming. And so some of the creators of Star Fox 2 went out and had drinks together after it was announced that the game was coming out. They're like, oh, well, finally, more than 20 years later, this game that we created and finished and QA tested and had prepped to go and marketed, it's finally coming out.
Yeah, I don't know how a lot of people feel about Star Fox 2, but for me, I saw it teased in Nintendo Power back in 95. I saw it in EGM when they covered it at the CES of that year, and I was really looking forward to it, and I was always disappointed that it never came out. So for me, this is a huge deal. This alone is enough to get a Super NES Classic Edition at any cost.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's anyone who is not at least intrigued by the prospect of Star Fox 2. I haven't seen a single person say, oh, I don't want that. I would much rather have, you know, like, I don't know, the Super FX version of Doom or something. Like, this is like a no-lose kind of thing. It's like when Earthbound came to Virtual Console for the first time, or Earthbound Beginnings was released in English a few years ago. Like, this is a pretty big deal. It's a game that's been lost to time. It's just been sitting in the archives collecting dust that has been dusted off and presented to the public to play. And like that alone, for anyone who's interested in kind of experiencing the history of these video games, like that alone right there is more than, you know, sufficient justification for hunting down and buying in a Super NES Mini.
Yeah, this is something Nintendo can offer that you can't get anywhere else. A couple Star Fox 2 work-in-progress ROMs have leaked out over the years, but even the most complete one is only like 95% complete.
Yeah, and Dylan Cuthbert has said like the finished game had more to it, and like the leaked version was not finished and was not the final game. So I don't know exactly how much more there is to Star Fox 2 than some of the beta versions that have leaked, but I'm hoping that it's better than the one that I played. I think the only one I've ever played has been a pretty early build where it was kind of not even a game yet. It was kind of abstract. It kind of reminded me of X for Game Boy, actually, where I was just like, this kind of seems like it's almost a game, but not quite. So hopefully, you know, having played the original Star Fox, I'm assuming that the game that we're going to get is more along those lines, more polished and complete.
Yes, I think even in its complete form, what you can expect is a very different experience from Star Fox 1. It was a very divergent sequel. They wanted to branch out and look at other things. You know, Miyamoto especially has always been resistant to the idea of iterative Star Fox sequels. He's always wanted to look at new ideas, for better or worse. But I think for Star Fox 2, it was definitely for the better. You don't get a lot of those long-form, intricately designed rail shooter stages. It's more focused on like small skirmishes. But these, you know, it's dogfights where you can now fly around in any direction, shooting down an enemy. It's very exciting, and it has this real-time strategy element where you go down to a planet, but while you're there, up on the world map, all these missiles and fighter squadrons are still homing in on Corneria, and you have to focus on defending them as well and managing your time. And there's also kind of a roguelike element where things would be randomized when you would start up a game. There might be missiles in different positions, or different planets would be captured by Andross. And I think the main thing missing from the early builds we've played so far is that there was more of that randomization for different scenarios every time you play, which is a really exciting proposition.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the team at Argonaut that did a lot of the programming work on Star Fox and Star Fox 2 hailed from, you know, personal computer backgrounds. And I feel like in a lot of respects, what they were trying to do with Star Fox 2 was sort of reintegrate some of those PC inspirations from the genre, like, you know, things like Star Control and Elite, and kind of create something that was more than just a linear rail shooter, which is a lot to ask for the poor Super NES. And I'm curious to see how well they pulled it off. I know that a lot of elements of Star Fox 2 have been pilfered for other sequels to the game, like Star Fox 64 and Star Fox Command. So I'm kind of, you know, interested in going back to the original game and seeing what's there and kind of exploring that.
Yeah, you can appreciate where all those different elements originated. And even though they have been in other games here and there, they've never really been all together in one game since Star Fox 2. So you get this unique combination that's uniquely appealing.
I agree. So any final thoughts on the Super NES Mini?
I'm trying to keep my expectations in check in terms of being able to find one, but boy, would I like to find one.
Yeah, that's going to be the challenge. I know a lot of people are ordering them from overseas because they're apparently kind of rolling out in waves for UK pre-orders, and a lot of places in the UK will ship overseas. So people who don't mind paying a premium, you know, converting their dollars to pounds, have been jumping on that. But I'm hoping that the American version will be pretty easy to get. I actually was able to pick up several NES Minis, not through scalping or anything like that. I just happened to be online at the right times. Like Amazon Prime was doing instant deliveries of them in like select markets one at a time, and I just happened to be at my computer when Raleigh, North Carolina came up. So I bought one and ended up giving that away. They make good gifts. So I'm hoping that I have luck again this year, and I'm hoping that everyone has luck, not just me, and that scalpers go away sad and can't actually sell their systems for more than list price. But I don't know. I'm not sure if Nintendo's quite up for doing the right thing yet.
Yeah, and I think because they've been upfront about this being a limited life product, inevitably there will be some people left out. So for them, I really hope Nintendo will bring whatever emulation solution they came up with for the Super FX games, bring it to Switch, bring Star Fox 2 to Switch, let everyone play it down the line at least.
Yeah, here's hoping. Nintendo moves in mysterious ways. All right, thanks a lot, Kishi. It was good having you on, and I don't doubt that we'll have you on again soon, so I'll look forward to that.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. So here for this final segment of this episode of Retronauts, I've brought on one of our bloggers, Kim Justice. Kim, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Kim Justice. I do a channel on YouTube where I do documentaries, reviews of video games, all that good stuff, mostly about European computer games, PlayStation, all that sort of thing. And just recently, I've been doing a five-part series. It wasn't supposed to be five-part, but it kind of got that way, about Final Fantasy VIII. I worked on
that. That's not a British computer game at all.
No, it's not. It might come out on the Spectrum one day. You never know, what with Homebrew and all that. Some sort of Final Fantasy or Bilo, I'm sure. But it's a game that I played sort of way back when for a little bit, and I decided that I actually wanted to finish it this time around. And so, yeah, I ended up doing combined about 4-hour video on it, which I made and released over, 6 weeks, 2 months, just full on. So, it's all done now, and it's all up to watch on YouTube. So if you go to my YouTube, you can find it. And I've been posting about it on Retronauts as well when the parts have come out.
Yeah, so why didn't you finish Final Fantasy VIII back in the day? What was it that kept you from playing all the way through?
My copy got stolen.
Oh, that'll do it.
Yes, and I never replaced it. I'd kind of come to a bit of a choke point, I guess is the word, like early on in it. I wasn't playing the game right, if I remember correctly. And there was one particular boss that just ruined me, which is kind of weird to think about now that I know just how easy Final Fantasy VIII is to break. I mean, you almost have to not try to just break the game completely, but I didn't the first time around.
Well, it was a really unconventional approach, not only to Final Fantasy, but to RPGs in general. It really... with the game, the developers really... It kind of feels like they did sort of like Hideo Kojima did with Metal Gear Solid 2, and yes, we're like, well, we have this massive success, we could just give people more of the same, or we could use this opportunity to do something really different and innovative and put that in front of our expected audience. And that's what they did. And the expected audience more or less said, no. yeah. It was very much a divisive game. I really liked it, and the more I've played it, the more I've liked it.
Mm-hmm.
But to really understand, you know, how easy it is to break, you have to stop thinking in terms of, you know, RPG dogma and sort of the standard processes. And most people, I wouldn't say they don't want to do that or aren't capable, but you know, I think there are certain expectations that come hand in hand with the name Final Fantasy. Definitely. And at that point, people weren't so much used to seeing Final Fantasy radically change every installment, which is kind of what it does now. But at the time, they were like, well, this isn't exactly like the other games, so what the hell?
Mm. I think it was also, especially for us in Europe, it was kind of different as well, because really, in Europe, we'd only had Final Fantasy VII.
Right, yeah, the console RPG was really slow to sort of take root over there, even more so than here in the US.
It was, yes. We never had Final Fantasy III or VI, didn't have Chrono Trigger, Earthbound. They all never... I mean, people imported them, but you can imagine how expensive that was, so very few people did it. I mean, they're expensive enough over in the States, I believe, back when they were released.
On cartridges they were, but once you got to the PlayStation, then they were pretty much standard price. So I think that made them a lot easier to swallow. But yeah, so that's kind of the background there. What was your ultimate kind of conclusion on Final Fantasy VIII? Where did you come out on the game, having played it all the way through, with the benefit of hindsight and nearly 20 years of experience and kind of tempered expectations?
Well, there was a lot of stuff that I didn't know at all going in. I never knew about things like the orphanage scene, for example, which is kind of infamous among the people who've played the game. Didn't really know. And there was a lot of stuff that, you know, it's kind of like the logic at some points just goes completely out of the window. Sometimes, in a way, that's kind of in character when you think of like the way that people like Laguna tend to act during the game. And he comes up with the big plan of like, right, well, you'll just move through time and sort this out. And it's like, okay, then how do we do that? Well, you just do it and you just find each other again. But then that's him, that's his character. So there's little kind of subtle things like that. It's on the whole, it was a very interesting experience. I enjoyed most of it. I mean, there's some parts of it that are just like, I don't know what you are thinking here, but it takes a lot of risks, as I said. I mean, it's like it's kind of like an RPG sandbox in many ways, especially in how the gameplay is, because all the characters are pretty much blank slates in terms of, you know, they don't have any specializations as such even. So you can kind of do what you want and just break the game in so many ways from the off. I mean, I think I played the game for about 5 hours before I even did the seed exam, just kind of experimenting with refining magic and doing triple triad and all that sort of thing. Just to get my party to a level that was like, right, okay, I feel comfortable to just go on and enjoy the story.
Well, did you discover throughout the game that maybe it was a mistake to level up your party?
No, not really. The thing is, I mean, the one thing that I didn't really like about a lot of Final Fantasy VIII was its dungeons. To be honest, some of them it was kind of like... I find a lot of the dungeons, I mean, obviously there's Ultimisha's castle at the end, which is fantastic and worth playing the whole of the game for. But then some of the other dungeons in the game I find to be a bit copy-pasted. Like things like the prison, the Deez District prison. It's just like you're going through the exact same floor over and over again. And so I was kind of happy to have like a strong party that I could just whiz through that. I mean, and it even then gives you things like you can level up Guardian Forces skills, like no encounters except for bosses, and it's like there's all sorts of things like that in it that make it, because obviously another thing about Final Fantasy VIII, if you don't know, is that leveling is bad, if like, the viewers
right.
don't
yeah
know.
that's what I was referring to. So when you said you were leveling your party up, you didn't necessarily mean experience levels, you meant more like getting them a breadth of skills and opportunities and so forth.
Yeah, exactly.
Junctioning magic to their stats.
Yeah, junctioning magic to stuff. Turning monsters into cards so that you don't get those fatal experience points.
You're right. Right. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that entire concept of avoiding level up is so counter to how we've been conditioned to play RPGs that it really took a lot of people off guard, and
certainly
the game has been kind of a hard sell for people, I think. But yeah, I really enjoy it just because of how unconventional it is. But you know, we'll eventually do a full-on Final Fantasy VIII Retronauts as part of our deep dive Final Fantasy series, so I don't want to get too much into it, but I do want to talk about one aspect of the game that I think is really kind of highly underappreciated, and that's the soundtrack, which in my opinion is maybe Nobu Uematsu's best work. I realize that's a bold claim, but
That is a very bold claim.
It is, but I love the soundtrack to this game. It really feels like the first time that Uematsu had, he had, you know, the technology and storage space at his disposal to finally create the music he wanted to. He was always constrained by cartridge limitations and hardware limitations on the Super NES, and Final Fantasy VII, I think, was kind of a learning experience getting used to the PlayStation sound. So it has this very sort of flat and lifeless feel to it, which, you know, fits the environment of Final Fantasy VII. It fits the themes of the game, but it can be a little bit of a difficult listen. But Final Fantasy VIII, like, it's a very diverse soundtrack with a very like kind of fresh live feel to it. And I think there is some live music actually within the game. So to me, it was kind of a revelation. Like I enjoyed Final Fantasy music before that, but this was the first time I was like, oh yeah, wow, this is amazing.
Yes, I mean, well, when you think of things like, just a general before we get into tracks, I mean, there's a lot of songs on the soundtrack with kind of like repeated motifs. Like you get the ones that have, that often have like the dun 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 dun, like that constant motif. I mean, I wonder if maybe like in earlier Final Fantasy games, that was something that Uematsu wasn't necessarily able to do, because maybe with like the limited range of samples, perhaps they'd all kind of sound similar, whereas in FF8, they all kind of have their different, wildly different takes and express different emotions because of that, a lot better than perhaps they would have earlier on.
No, actually, leitmotifs were something that Uematsu did a lot, starting with really Final Fantasy IV, where you had sort of like the central theme of Final Fantasy IV, and it's repeated through these different variants, and sometimes very strangely. Final Fantasy V did the same thing as well, and then Final Fantasy VI, you got character motifs, leitmotifs, so you can kind of tell like when a scene was built around a specific character, because their theme would kind of come in, and that, you know, sort of tied in with the game's sort of centerpiece, musical centerpiece being an opera. So it's actually something he really did a lot, but it does show up here, and I think it is put to use in a much more subtle way than in the past. And it has a really good it helps unify the overall soundtrack, even though it is musically the most diverse Final Fantasy soundtrack to that point.
Oh, definitely. I mean, when you think of things like the S-Star theme, for example, I don't think Uematsu had done much like that before. I mean, certainly less so in FF7, that kind of like...
where it's kind of dissonant?
Sort of minimalist, that sort of ploppy sort of sound. I mean, some people think that's one of like the least of the tracks on FF8, but I can see what he was going for with that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did something sort of similar with the lunar terrain theme on Final Fantasy IV, but that was almost just like there are sound effects and sort of like an ominous timpani in the background, whereas S-Star is more... it's fully developed. It's fully fleshed out. And I think that's what he was able to do with the soundtrack, was to take some of his recurring ideas and really sort of build them up into something more musical, more robust. And so I think the soundtrack holds up really well. So what's your favorite track from the Final Fantasy VIII soundtrack?
I would say that my favorite track is probably I like all the final boss themes, like for the Ultimisha battle, but particularly the extreme.
Thank you. that's when you're fighting the Griever summon, basically.
I think that's the last form of Ultimacia, when you're fighting her like in space, like or in like, time and space.
Right. So yeah, okay. So that's it's trying to remember. That starts out with like a chorus of voices, sort of.
Yes, it's got like a chorus of voices, and it kind of goes into a sort of very sort of slow sort of acoustic guitar, I think harp actually, mm-hmm. maybe. Mm-hmm. Kind of like Vincent's theme in a way, if you that mm-hmm. from F7. And it sort of does that for a minute, and then it kicks into, the classic like Final Fantasy boss theme, you know, like the
right with like the kick drum and the sort of staccato, very forceful upbeat strings and everything.
Mm, absolutely, and kind of goes into sort of a very sort of heavy prog rock direction from there.
As Uematsu often does. Yes. Yeah, I think that piece really fits the battle because of all the Final Fantasy multi-phase final battles, the one with Ultimacia is the one that took me the longest to complete mm-hmm. because she has the ability to like strip away your powers as you're battling.
Yes.
So not only does it remove an ability, it also diminishes whatever capability happens to be junctions to that. And then she's also like knocking members of your party out. Mm. And like, if they die, then they're replaced with someone else. And eventually you run out of people to replace them with. So it becomes a sort of grueling contest of endurance.
It's a tough battle.
Yeah. Okay. So even knowing all the tricks, you had a tough time with it.
I managed to get lucky and beat her first time through. She fortunately didn't knock out any of my like attack junctions or anything, so I was still able to like do damage, but I only had like two characters left by the end.
Okay, yeah, that was kind of my experience. I've only played all the way through Final Fantasy VIII once, and I didn't know all the tricks. I kind of intuited a lot and stumbled into a lot of things, but I hadn't, you know, read advanced strategies about here's how to min-max the game or anything like that. So I didn't have, you know, the ability to just go in and completely stomp her like some people do. But yeah, that battle took me a really long time to finish, like probably the better part of an hour just for that one phase of the battle. But I refused to give up and just clung on tenaciously, even though she like stripped away the spells that were junctioned to my character's health, and she knocked out four of my party members, so I was down to two. And it was basically like Squall delivering damage, and then Rinoa was like casting magic, and then she would die because she had like 1,000 hit points after she had her junction stripped away.
Yeah.
So then Squall would have to revive her. So it just took forever.
It took a long time.
It was intense, and the music I think really works well with that.
I was left with Squall and Selphie by the end. I tended to use Selphie quite a lot.
Like yeah, she's the best character in the game. Maybe not like from a gameplay standpoint, but as a character, she's the best character.
She's just so fun. Just always talks about blowing fins up.
Yeah, she's secretly violent, but she also loves trains.
Yep, adores trains. Train, take us away.
Exactly. So, I would say my favorite Final Fantasy VIII theme is probably the Balam Garden theme, which is good because you hear that so much throughout the game. It's just it's so relaxing and so melodic, and it has, it's again, one of those instances, like one of the first times in the game where you start to appreciate the broader range of instrument sounds available to Uematsu, because a lot of it is kind of played on oboe, I think, or maybe, I don't know, some sort of reed instrument, but it has this sort of like... Yeah, so it has this sort of like not jazzy, but just like a very peaceful sound to it.
Yeah, just nice and understated.
And it never really gets boring. And like I said, it's good because you spend a lot of time in the garden. It's the first Final Fantasy where you have sort of a central home base that you return to over and over again, which is a really different concept in the series. Like, up until then, Final Fantasy was always a quest where your party was always being pushed from one place to the next. But here, you know, you had Garden as sort of like the academy where all the students went to. And so it became sort of their home base. And that's like the sound of your home base, which is really nice.
Exactly. It's exactly. I agree with pretty much everything you said on that one. It's because, yeah, even something like Midgar in FF7, even though that's kind of one place, it has obviously all different places. So you get lots of themes, but
yeah, you're constantly moving through Midgar to different locations. So even though you spend, God, probably like 8 or 10 hours total in Midgar throughout the game, you're never just like in one spot there.
No, it's a really nice theme. It's definitely one of the better ones from the game, I think, especially as far as like the towns go. I mean, I think that some of the other themes, like with regards to like towns and sort of and the world map theme as well, perhaps a bit less memorable, but that one does stand out.
Yeah, the world map theme is interesting because it's so different than usual. It's like plucked strings and tuned percussion, and it sounds very not jarring, but it just has a really unusual sound for a Final Fantasy musical theme. But
yeah,
I like it. It's just not one that I want to listen to a lot.
No, same.
So you highlighted a couple of other game a couple of other themes from the game. What else did you have on your list of favorites?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I'm one of those people who do like the Eyes on Me song, I have to say.
Never say my songs on the stage on my own. Said my words, wishing they would be heard. I saw you smiling at me. Was it real or just my fantasy? You'd always be there in the corner of this tiny little bar.
Okay, now that was a pretty controversial song at the time because, you know, like, it's a vocal theme in Final Fantasy. It's a love theme. Like, the series had never had anything like that. But you're okay with it. You're okay with it, even though it's like a pretty famous, I think, Asian pop singer singing it. And you can still dredge that up at karaoke if you go to the right places.
I imagine so, yeah, back in some sort of dark corner, probably. I'm really okay with the song. I get a sort of soft spot. I think it soundtracks a nice moment in the game as well, especially after you kind of just get off of one of the game's more, you know, when the Lunar Cry happens and, you know, Rinoa gets properly possessed, and it's all a bit much, but then you get the kind of nice scene with Rinoa and Squall, and you get that soundtrack in, and I dig it. It's one of my better liked sort of vocal songs from games, you know. Probably not as good as like Snake Eater, but better than I Am the Wind.
Yeah, vocal themes in video games from the late 90s tended to be more on the miss than hit side. I think they sort of captured maybe more of a success and more of a hit with that song than they intended to with Eyes on Me. And they spent a lot of time trying to recapture that. I don't know that they've ever really been that successful. Maybe Kingdom Hearts Clean and Simple is the only other one that really compares, but every Final Fantasy since then has had some sort of like, hey, Top of the Pops kind of vocal theme that never quite takes. I did like the in Final Fantasy 13, the Sunleth Waterway has a vocal theme, but it's not positioned the same in the game. It's not meant to be like a love theme or like the central theme of the game. It's just a theme when you're exploring that happens to have vocals to it, which is like very unusual, but it works really well there.
Strange. Kind of like, I guess, Blue Dragon as well, with Eternity as like just the constant boss theme, which is just pretty Again, not definitely not a love theme, that one.
No. yeah, but you know, Eyes on Me was a very different kind of song for Final Fantasy VIII, for Final Fantasy, and so was the alternative battle theme, which accompanied the battle scenes with Laguna that you play through when Cloud has, or Cloud, Squall has his his like psychotic fits or whatever. He like falls into a dream and dreams about this completely goofy dude who fights with the army. But you know, you're kind of used to the sort of prog rock orchestral themes all the way from Final Fantasy I up through Final Fantasy VIII. Like Final Fantasy VIII's main battle theme starts out almost like a newscast introduction. It's like very bold, brassy,
yes,
kind of like a very steady driving rhythm. And then you get to Laguna's battle theme, the man with the machine gun, so-called because Laguna fights with a machine gun. And and instead of being like any other Final Fantasy battle theme before, it's just like straight up EDM. It's like techno music. It's kind of a little cheesy with the drum machines and the but it
kind of sounds like a sort of a TV theme almost. I was
a little bit, but then you know it kind of the main melody sort of kicks in, and I guess the closest thing that Final Fantasy had done before was the Genova battle theme, but this isn't nearly that intense and dark. It's much more sort of poppy and upbeat, and it just sounds so strange, and it really complements those scenes in the game, because the first time you have a Laguna sequence, you have no idea what's going on. You're like, you're playing as Cloud, and then all of a sudden you're playing as some other guy, and he's with these other two dudes, one of whom attacks by throwing an anchor at people.
Yes.
It's like super crazy, and you have no idea what the hell is happening. And then you go to like a bar and he's trying badly to hit on a woman and you're just like, what? And it's so disorienting. And so is that battle theme. It's just so unlike anything else that's ever been in any Final Fantasy before. You're just like, what is this? So it really does a great job of kind of setting that part of the game separate and making it sort of clear musically that, yeah, this isn't part of the main adventure. This is something else.
Yeah. It's something completely different, you know, just let it happen sort of thing.
And then your final pick to talk about, that was
The Salt Flats.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's not one that really stands out to me that I would have picked out. So I'm curious, what is it you like about that track?
I just love it. It's got a very gloomy sort of mood to it. I mean, although the dungeons, again, as I said before, I don't particularly like them necessarily. I do think that the music in them, I mean, probably, I think it's Find Your Way is probably the more famous example. But I just like the Salt Flats has got this very like sort of pondering sort of gloominess. And it's just a case of just a track that just fits the surroundings perfectly. Just those lovely like pre-rendered graphics. And it's just before you get to Estar. You're kind of just in this desolate landscape. And you can pretty much see right to the end of the continent. And there doesn't seem to be anything there. So it almost kind of makes you feel a bit lost.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's something that I think obviously that Uematsu's kind of done before in other Final Fantasy games. there just seems to be something slightly different to that. Again, maybe it's just the fact that maybe like just the little technical things, like it being in kind of like waltz time as well, just gives it that sort of slightly different feel other dungeon themes of his.
Yeah, I agree. I admit that part of the game doesn't stick with me that well because it's, you know, like deserts are never that interesting to look at. And also it's kind of short. And then there's a boss that you fight and it's an undead boss. And
it is, yes.
I didn't quite realize the properties of some of my abilities at that point. And there's one menu command you can get that gives you like a free super healing ability. And so I tried using that on the boss and it killed it in one shot. And I was like, oh, well, that was anticlimactic. I wonder what's supposed to happen there.
So it's good for so that dead bosses get the X potion out.
Yeah. So that boss, like that whole section is just kind of like this. Oh, well, that's done. Okay. On to the next for me. Yeah. So we've kind of, I think we've like the common thread between all the musical picks we've named so far has been how they're sort of like interesting, distinct musical forms so far. And the final track that I wanted to call out is pretty much along those same lines, and that's The Spy. Which is the theme that plays when you're sneaking around in the missile base, and it's Selfie and her team. And
quite a fun bit, yeah.
Yeah, like that's an interesting bit because it's kind of a dungeon, but you don't really fight people so much. It's more like
you kind of
sneak around. Section, yeah, it's not even really stealth. It's more like you're in disguise. It's not so much about like trying to avoid being seen, but more like just kind of try to blend in. So it kind of stands out, but then the music itself is just like this kind of funky sort of guitar driven piece that would not be out of place in like some 70s police movie.
Exactly.
And again, that was really different for Final Fantasy at the time also.
Getting that kind of the whacka whacka sort of guitar going as well. That's an interesting pick. I think it's something that he was starting to do as well with Final Fantasy VII, with a couple of the themes now. Particularly, I'm thinking one of like the slum themes that kind of becomes a dungeon theme, like the da da dun da dun. Like, sort of has a similar vibe to that, but then FF8, like The Spy, is sort of like a tighter, more refined version.
Well, and on top of that, it actually has like real guitar samples in it, which really makes it stand out, because that was kind of the big thing with Final Fantasy VIII, was like all of a sudden you started to hear real instruments, you know, like I mentioned oboes earlier. And then here you had this sort of like, you know, very kind of authentic sounding chunky guitar. And I think that was kind of Uematsu showing off a little bit. I think he was really proud of the fact that he got to bring his pet guitar into the game's soundtrack. And the Chocobo theme is actually, it's mods to Chocobo, I think, in this game. Uh-huh. And the subtitle is actually like featuring Inn's Stratocaster. So it's like, hey, check it out. I get to use my guitar and I get to put that in.
Lost.
So there's like this little element of kind of like pride to the musical sound of this piece. And that makes me really happy. It's just like, you don't really get to see individual expression so often in a game of this scale and scope, you know, when you have hundreds of people working on a game and it's four discs long and 60 hours of gameplay, like everything kind of becomes systems oriented and team oriented. But then there's one little bit where the composer's like, yeah, I'm going to put a little bit of myself in here. And
it's quite nice.
I think the Chocobo theme is more upbeat, but The Spy is where I really noticed and was like, oh yeah, this is something you would not have heard in a previous Final Fantasy game because you just didn't get these kind of audio samples. And I think that's less special now because, you know, audio quality in games has improved so much, but at the time it was something that really stood out.
Definitely.
So that's a pretty, I would say, pretty eclectic sampling of music, and maybe that's maybe that's the appropriate Final Fantasy VIII experience, the authentic Final Fantasy VIII experience. It's eclectic.
Everyone will have their different favorite bits.
So do you ever think you'll return to Final Fantasy VIII, or do you think this one playthrough is pretty much like you've done your time and it's time to move along, get on with life?
Yeah, I think it's probably time to move along to the next thing. I had a nice go with it for a bit, and that's definitely satisfied as far as that game goes, and so, perhaps as far as Final Fantasy itself goes for a while.
Yeah. That's understandable. One of those games is a pretty big commitment.
Yes.
So what do you see as like the next venture for yourself? Are you going to do any more big projects for video, or are you going to keep it small for a while?
I'm certainly not. It's be a while before the next like multi-part series or anything. I release videos almost every week, so I've got one coming up about the Xbox in Japan. And it's sort of mixed fortunes over there. And I'm currently working on
mixed?
Something...
That's generous.
I'm currently working on something to do with Half-Life as well.
Interesting.
This will be kind of a fun trip back, seeing how sort of good it is to play now sort of thing.
Okay. Well, I'm sure everyone can look forward to seeing those posted on Retronauts.com.
Absolutely.
But would you like to tell everyone where else they can find you on the internet in case they want to seek you out specifically and check out your body of work?
No problemo. Where you can find me on YouTube, you could just search Kim Justice or enter youtube.com/KimballJustice. I'm also on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Patreon, I'm on all that sort of good stuff. So do feel free to search for me and you can check all that stuff out. And also I occasionally do write-ins for Retro Gamer. And of course you can find me every weekday on Retronauts.
Okay, great. And I've already done my spiel in a different part of the episode, so I won't belabor the point. Kim, thanks for joining us. I definitely want to get you on at least once a month if you're good for that, to talk about different things. Maybe in the future we can talk about things that are more along your specialties as opposed to your sort of odd excursion into Final Fantasy's realm.
Yes, no problemo. I look forward to it.
But yeah, it's great to get more exposure to areas of gaming that I think I don't know that much about and Bob doesn't know that much about. So you're providing a valuable service.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Jeremy.
Thank you for joining us. And everyone else can look forward to more of Kim's work on the site and hopefully in the podcast in the future.
Okay. Cheers.
See you, Starside.